we're very excited that this $15 million will allow the community of Newtok to realize their dream of moving to McTarvik.
The federal spending bill includes millions for a village relocation project. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a crash at a South Central bridge causes massive traffic jams and costly damage.
We will likely have to both do the removal and replacement from on top of the bridge.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV.
The U.S. House has passed a bill to keep the federal government funded for the rest of the fiscal year. It's not expected to pass the Senate until the weekend, which will likely cause a brief government shutdown. The bill is a few thousand pages, but we've got Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin on the line to tell us what's in it for Alaska. So tell us what Alaska items are in this bill.
Okay, but first I want to start telling you what's not in the bill, and that is Tongass logging riders. Now, we've been expecting for weeks that Senator Murkowski would get a couple provisions in this bill to support more logging or continued logging in the Tongass National Forest, and those riders aren't in the bill. We were expecting a exemption for the Tongass from the roadless rule. That's not in the bill.
Liz, remind us the roadless rule. Remind us what that is.
Yeah, the roadless rule stems from the Clinton administration, the last days of the Clinton administration. Basically, it bans new road building in areas that don't have roads. So, but that continues to apply to the Tongass as it did before. Senator Murkowski did not get an exemption in this spending bill for the Tongass. Other things she did not get is a block for the Tongass management plan that she does not like. We were expecting her to block that plan. It's not in the bill.
That's the transition to logging younger trees rather than old growth, right?
Yes, exactly. And there's not a block in the bill on that plan, but she did get an instruction to the Forest Service telling the Forest Service not to complete the transition until they complete a tree inventory to show that that there are enough young growth logs to support the industry.
All right, Liz, a few thousand pages. What is in the bill for Alaska?
It doubles the funding for the Denali Commission, bringing it to $30 million. That's interesting because the Trump administration had proposed to give the Denali Commission a 50% cut, and instead they're getting a 100% increase. And then Senator Murkowski's office sent a press release that listed all kinds of other spending on national programs that Alaska benefits from. One of them is the payment in lieu of taxes. That's a program that supports local governments and compensates them for the federal lands near them that they can't tax. So that's called PILT, payment in lieu of taxes. There's a lot of money for water and wastewater systems in rural areas. And she points out a record amount of spending for the Indian Health Service. And also, as Representative Don Young points out in his press release, there's almost $170 million for military construction at Eielson Air Force Base. That's to prepare for the arrival of the F-35 squadrons.
Liz, does anything else stand out to you as it relates to Alaska in this legislation?
Yes, I did notice $150 million for a new icebreaker. It's one incremental step, another incremental step in the process of acquiring one or more new icebreakers, heavy icebreakers. Each one is costs around $1 billion, maybe a little less.
That was Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reporting from Washington. And as Liz mentioned, the federal spending bill doubles the funding for the Denali Commission, which funds infrastructure in rural Alaska. The commission says virtually all the new money will go to the eroding village of Nutok in western Alaska. Nutok has been trying to move for years. As Rachel Waldholz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, this funding could finally break the logjam.
The spending bill gives the Denali Commission $15 million to address the most urgent needs of Alaska villages facing erosion, flooding, and permafrost degradation. Joel Niemeyer is the commission's co-chair. He says the most urgent need in Alaska right now is the village of Nutok, which is losing about 70 feet of land each year to coastal erosion and thawing permafrost. Residents worry it will become completely uninhabitable within the next few years. They've been trying to move to a new site, Murtarvik, which is several miles away. Niemeyer says this funding could finally make that happen.
We're very excited that this $15 million will allow the community of Nutok to realize their dream of moving to Murtarvik.
Nutok has been trying to piece together enough funding to move to the new site for more than a decade. But they found themselves in a catch-22. Government agencies that fund housing won't build homes where there's no infrastructure. But agencies that fund infrastructure, like water, sewer, or power, won't spend money on a village where nobody lives. Niemeyer says the new money could break that cycle.
I would hope that this $15 million will get us halfway to where the community needs in terms of housing stock. That really is a real community. That you know, there are enough people living there that the other funding agencies will have to say that is community and our money will be put to good use.
That would be a landmark moment for the village and the state, which has not managed to move a single village threatened by climate change despite years of work. Niemeyer says if Nutok can move successfully, it could be a model for other villages like Shishmaref, Shaktulik, or Kivalina.
If we in Alaska can show Congress we can take their funds and put it to good use and show that we can do this efficiently, effectively, and smartly, perhaps that'll open up the checkbook for the other communities which face erosion.
Meanwhile, leaders in Nutok say they're not quite ready to talk about the funding. After years of waiting, they're holding off until the bill is officially passed into law. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Traffic has been a major headache for thousands of South Central Alaska commuters due to a reroute of the Glen Highway between the Matanuska-Susitna Borough and Anchorage. A tall load on a semi-trailer collided with a highway overpass bridge near Eagle River yesterday, and damage to the bridge forced transportation officials to close the highway's southbound lanes. As Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, the state's busiest commute was detoured through Eagle River today, causing hours-long delays. And the fallout has prompted closures Friday for schools in the area.
Some described the bumper-to-bumper traffic in nightmarish terms. Others jokingly called it bridge-pocalypse, as many drivers trying to get to Anchorage were stuck in their cars for 5 hours or more. An average of 57,000 vehicles travel the Glen Highway every day on a commute that's usually less than 1 hour for most. Thursday morning's commute funneled all of those drivers into Eagle River, choking the small community's streets.
Obviously, this is a huge inconvenience.
Shannon McCarthy is a spokesperson for the Department of Transportation. She says the inconvenience is a necessary precaution because pieces of the damaged bridge could still come off.
That's our main concern, is cars driving under it and potentially having the span fall.
A prefabricated building carried atop an 18-wheeler slammed into the bridge Wednesday, shearing off the top of the building and leaving splintered wood and chunks of concrete all over the highway. Photos of the semi indicate it is owned by Bighorn Enterprises. Calls to the Fairbanks-based trucking company went unanswered Thursday. Police say the driver was uninjured and there are no early indications he or she was driving impaired or broke any traffic laws. But while DOT says the semi was permitted to carry an oversized load, the load was apparently too tall for the bridge, and the damage was extensive.
When our bridge inspectors were really able to get up there and look at it, what they really found was that the whole thing was shattered, so that the concrete is pulverized and it's not holding any weight anymore. And what is the most problematic part of this is that it's at risk of falling onto the southbound lane.
The bridge's clearance is listed at a little over 18 feet. and McCarthy says the permit was for a load up to 17 feet tall. It's unclear how tall the load actually was. McCarthy says DOT is still looking into who is at fault in the accident and, ultimately, whether the shipping company might be held liable for the cost of repairing the bridge.
You know, it's going to be an investigation.
To get the highway reopened, McCarthy says DOT workers will first have to remove some concrete and a 100-ton steel girder on one side of the bridge. That could take 3 to 5 days. She says reinstalling a new girder will be done later and will involve shutting down the highway again.
That's going to be a longer project. When we do replace, we're going to want to pick a time period where that is low volume. We will likely have to both do the removal and replacement from on top of the bridge.
McCarthy says DOT has asked the state for an emergency appropriation of $1.8 million for the total repair cost. Meantime, criticism of the detour route from drivers stuck in traffic for hours who were trying to get to jobs, appointments, or to the airport was fierce. Anchorage Police Spokesperson MJ Tim says the decision to route traffic through Eagle River was made in the interest of safety after the initial highway closure.
It's a small, concentrated area. You've got a major, you know, highway, but outside of that, you've got residential roads and smaller roads, so the options were limited.
Tim says DOT officials and Anchorage Police were planning on changing the detour route in the hopes of easing congestion for commuters in the coming days. Not all of the reaction was negative, though. Posts on the Facebook group Glen Highway Traffic Report showed someone dressed in a turtle costume running alongside backed-up traffic faster than the cars were moving. A couple people also sat in lawn chairs offering moral support with a sign that read, "Hang in there." Then there were young entrepreneurs like Alexis Sammartino and Lily O'Mara.
We decided to start a hot chocolate and tea stand so people can buy it so it passed the time. We've made $7. We decided to split it equally and
50-50.
Yeah, 50-50.
The girls were not sure yet what they'd spend the money on, but it will likely not be on the cost of replacing the bridge. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
All Eagle River and Chugiak area schools will be closed tomorrow, and some state employees will not be required to be at work. Also, Anchorage Police announced late today that a ramp off the Glen Highway is being converted to allow traffic around the damaged bridge without going through downtown Eagle River. But police warn there is one lane at that spot and likely still traffic congestion. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the ACLU is suing the city of Palmer over an immigration case.
Police officers do not have legal authority to arrest anyone just for being undocumented. Being undocumented is not a crime.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
A civil rights group is suing an Alaska police department over what it says was the unlawful arrest and detention of an immigrant last summer. Today, the Alaska chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union filed a complaint in state court on behalf of Palmer resident Andres Alexander Quesada Mantilla. Court documents detail an incident at Klondike Mike's Saloon last August when Quesada Mantilla was badly beaten by three individuals after he rushed to the defense of a bartender.
One of our security guys got his head busted in.
In an 8-minute video released by the ACLU, members of the Palmer Police Department show up to arrest the assailants, but detain Quesada Mantilla shortly after he tells them he's from Peru and has only a passport as documentation. The court filing says that Detective Christy Muhlenberg told a police dispatcher to call Immigrations and Customs Enforcement and eventually handcuffed Quesada Mantilla, placing him in the back of a police car as he continued bleeding from a head wound that eventually required 8 stitches.
Yeah, even if you didn't commit a crime, it's something that the Department of Homeland Security wants. It's not us. It's a federal thing.
At the heart of the ACLU complaint is whether or not it was lawful for Quesada Mantilla to be put under arrest and detained for 4 days when there was no evidence he'd committed a criminal offense. Casey Reynolds is the communications director for the ACLU in Alaska and says under Alaska law, state or local police are not in charge of enforcing immigration violations.
Police officers do not have legal authority to arrest anyone just for being undocumented. Being undocumented is not a crime, it's a civil violation. And under Alaska law, in order for police to arrest anyone, they have to have belief that a crime has occurred. So it was an unlawful arrest.
Quesada Mantilla is married to a U.S. citizen, though has not yet started filing for a green card. He was eventually released by ICE. According to the ACLU, all three of the men who assaulted Quesada Mantilla were released by officers at the scene. The suit seeks damages, saying Quesada Mantilla's physical injuries were made worse as a result of being handcuffed and detained. The lawsuit names the city of Palmer as a defendant, along with the four individual members of the police department involved in the incident, Christy Muhlenberg, Jamie Hammonds, Daniel Potter, and Hillary Schwader. The ACLU's Reynolds says this was to send a message to law enforcement across the state.
At the end of the day, it's the individual police officers who make the decision whether to take somebody into custody or not. So we're holding the people who actually committed the unlawful arrest accountable.
The city of Palmer has not yet responded to the complaint. The state budget is largely unchanged after 3 days of debate on the Alaska House floor. The House defeated more than 40 amendments and passed four. One amendment added $211,000 for rural emergency response. Minority caucus Republicans offered amendments that would cut $28 million, but none passed. A series of amendments intended to put limits on the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation were also defeated. One offered by Wasilla Republican Representative David Eastman would have shifted money from AGDC to state pension funding. While many Republican lawmakers have criticized Governor Bill Walker's handling of the gas line, only five House members voted for Eastman's amendment. Nikiski Republican Mike Chenault voted against it.
If we continue to be afraid to make that investment, to get to a point where we see if we have a viable project or not, in 30 years we'll be saying the same thing that we're saying today, is that we should have went forward and completed a project.
There are still many amendments that haven't been debated. They include expected amendments to restore full funding for Alaska Permanent Fund dividends. The federal government has taken a key step toward permitting a new oil development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, west of Prudhoe Bay. The Bureau of Land Management today released a draft environmental impact statement for the Greater Moose's Tooth 2 project, or GMT-2. The permitting process for GMT-2 has taken much longer than expected for ConocoPhillips, the company behind the project. Conoco is now aiming for first oil in 2021, a year later than it originally planned. If it goes forward, GMT-2 would be Conoco's third oil development inside the National Petroleum Reserve. Natalie Lohman is a spokesperson for Conoco.
The CIS will help us look at, you know, the best way to develop this project, and it's just a really important step in developing on the North Slope.
Lohman says the $1.5 billion project could produce up to 30,000 barrels of oil per day. The project would be west of the village of Nuiqsut. The BLM says potential impacts to Nuiqsut and its subsistence resources will be of particular interest as it weighs permitting the development. The BLM will take public comments on Conoco's proposal until May 7th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
Thank you. More than 90% of households in Bethel use heating oil to keep warm, according to census data. But a lot of people supplement with wood, even though there are no trees on the tundra. And then there's Jeff Sanders, who exclusively heats his 3,000-square-foot home in Bethel with wood he scavenges around town. As part of the Alaska's Energy Desk series, The Cost of Cold, Sanders says he hasn't used heating fuel since 1974.
I'm an opportunistic wood gatherer. In the window work I do, there's a lot of crating, and it's all wood crating. I burn that. Comes right off my own job site. Oftentimes pallets are available. They're easy to work with. Actually, sometimes there's enough paper products up at the post office that I can heat my house for long periods of time with what's left on the tables at the post office. Quite notably, a couple weeks ago, there was a religious booklet there that I think we're in a community that likes to find their own way to the Lord, so they were being discarded in heaps. And I think I heated my house with those booklets for about 3 days straight. This is one of my favorite kind of wood. Not only because it's dry spruce, but because it's just the right size so I don't have to split it. Here, we'll give it a lot of air and let it rip. Maybe you'll be able to. I don't want to spend the money for fuel. Plus, I just, I guess it's a green aspect of my life. I just prefer not to burn fossil fuels or use them. Sometimes it's unavoidable. And I probably don't do any better job of avoiding using them than anybody else. But when I can, I try to use other forms of energy. Probably there's costs I just don't bother to keep track of. Gathering wood a lot of times requires gasoline to go get it.
And time?
I'm not considering my time either. I enjoy it enough that it kind of supplants recreation. If I was in Anchorage, maybe I'd be spending the time going to the theater. But here I just like to be out in my yard chopping wood.
The Cost of Cold is a series from Alaska's Energy Desk about how Alaskans around the state heat their homes. Reporter Christine Trudeau produced this story from Bethel. If someone breaks their arm or twists an ankle, we generally know what to do, brace it and get help. But what if someone is hurting mentally instead of physically? A bandage won't help, but a mental health first aid class will. Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk has more.
Two women sit in a classroom, role-playing what it would be like to be in a turbulent airplane when a person experiences a panic attack.
Oh, hey. Are you okay? Is there anything I can do to help you? Can you breathe? Can you just try to relax and breathe? Take a deep breath.
Amber Atagiak listens to the other woman's concerns and tries to reassure her. She suggests slow breathing and thinking happy thoughts. Listening without judgment, giving reassurance, and encouraging self-help strategies, those are some of the main skills taught in mental health first aid classes around the world. And they work.
Okay, so this just short little flight, and then we'll get there, and everything will be okay. We're going to be all right.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah? I think so. I think I'm good. I'm breathing better. Thank you.
Sure. No problem. Just let me know if you need anything.
Even though it was just a role-playing exercise in a safe space, and even though Atagiak has been around people who were having mental health crises before, she says it was scary.
It was an intense situation. I mean, because, you know, things like that could really happen. And I wasn't sure if it was going to get out of hand or if she was going to get physical or, you know, and you never know.
Part of the idea behind mental health first aid is to train people to respond appropriately to help another person when situations are tense. The class helps people assist with short-term mental health crises, like a panic attack on a plane or suicidal thoughts, and to broach longer-term issues like depression or substance abuse. Jill Ramsey is the behavioral health training coordinator for the University of Alaska Anchorage and has been teaching the class for more than 6 years.
The context ranges from with
with one's own family to work situations, even strangers on the street.
Just like CPR, mental health first aid focuses on a series of steps. Assess the risk. Is the person thinking of hurting themselves or others? Listen to the person and hear what their concerns are, and then give them reassurance if they need it. Then, help them connect with resources. She says the class teaches necessary skills for a first response, not a long-term intervention.
We really don't want people diagnosing other people. We don't want people out there trying to be therapists. We really want people to do first aid.
The 8-hour-long course was developed in Australia in 2001 and is now taught around the world, including Pakistan, Denmark, and Saudi Arabia. It teaches the signs and symptoms associated with major illnesses like depression, anxiety, and substance abuse, as well as the appropriate way to respond. Research shows participants develop, maintain, and use their new knowledge over time. The program also reduces the stigma around mental illness. About 1 in 5 people in the United States has a mental illness. Ramsey says awareness of the illnesses and their prevalence changes how people interact and respond.
You know, most of the things that we're seeing are brain disorders. They're not character flaws. They're not moral failures. These are real illnesses that deserve attention and compassion.
There aren't any studies with people who have received mental health first aid. It's hard to track those folks down. But anecdotally, the methods are effective. Ruth Adolph is an officer with the Anchorage Police Department and helps teach the course to other officers and the general public. She says people who interact with officers who have had mental health first aid training are calmer and more responsive because the officers listen with a greater awareness.
It's very important to understand when you go into a situation what you're dealing with, and you can easily learn that by being patient, by taking your time, by learning from that person what's going on. Not always easy, but it's you know, necessary, it's valuable.
Adolph says the class is now part of the Police Training Academy in Anchorage. It's also taught to healthcare professionals and the general public. A youth-specific version is available too. With the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman in Anchorage.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholtz, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Christine Trudeau in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. Thanks for listening today. We love being a part of your media mix. Tune in every day to catch the best in statewide news and programming. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.